What's up, bosses? A quick word from our sponsor before we kick off this episode. The thing about running your own business is every single hire counts. And no hiring partner understands that like Indeed. Indeed is the hiring platform where you can attract, interview, and hire all in one place. Don't spend hours on multiple job sites looking for candidates with the right skills when you can do it all with Indeed. You can find top talent fast with Indeed's suite of powerful hiring tools like Indeed Instant Match, assessments, and virtual interviews. I'm going to tell you all about those features and more during the break in the show. But if you want to get a jump start, just visit Indeed.com/iLab to start hiring now. Indeed knows that when you're doing everything for your company, you can't afford to overspend on hiring. So just go to Indeed.com/iLab. That's Indeed.com/ILAB. Terms and conditions apply. Cost per application. Pricing not available for everyone. Need to hire? You need Indeed. All right, let's kick off this episode of Invest Like a Boss.
Welcome to the Invest Like a Boss podcast.
I'm Sam Marks.
And I'm Johnny FD. We're self-made entrepreneurs who invest our own money and use modern technology to invest like a boss.
Join us each week for exclusive interviews with our network of modern investors, business owners, and multimillionaires to discover new ways to invest our hard-earned cash.
What is up, guys? This is Johnny, and welcome to the Invest Like a Boss podcast. I'm in Kyiv, Ukraine, and Sam is in hot, sunny Barcelona.
Two shirtless amigos about to record an episode on something going up, and it's not the heat, it's inflation.
Yeah, well, the heat seems like it's going up as well.
Yeah, everyone's crying in Barcelona about the humidity. I'm like, this is not humidity. You haven't been to the Southeast USA. You want to talk about humidity. It's dry here.
Or Southeast Asia.
That's right. Yeah. I guess we have lived in the kind of like the most humid place on Earth. So everything by comparison is pretty dry.
Yeah. I don't even really consider it. I think sometimes I'll go home and I'll feel a little bit stickier than I'm used to. And I'll kind of forget why that is, because I'm just so not used to being like unpleasant here. Mm-hmm. In Kyiv, it gets to maybe 26. It really doesn't. I mean, I guess it gets to like 30 Celsius once in a while, which is like what, 89 Fahrenheit. But it really doesn't get that hot, even in the summer.
High 80s. Yeah. Today was 34, which is let's see, double it, 70. No, 34. You double it and add 30, right?
I don't know.
That's almost 100. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. It's pretty hot here. Today was the first day I was like, damn, this is pretty hot. And the thing in Barcelona is like most people don't have AC. They just have fans. Mm. So that's where you really notice it. You blast yourself with a fan at night, but you're just still kind of hot and sticky. It's like, it's always like 3 weeks a year here that people just have trouble sleeping. Yeah. I rented an Airbnb here once that didn't have AC during that time. And it was pretty tough,
man. I just looked it up. 34 Celsius is 93 Fahrenheit, which is hot, especially at night if there's no AC. That's very hot.
So that calculation doesn't work. All you people that think you just double it and add 30, it fails on the higher numbers.
Yeah. You know, somebody was trying to say like, I don't know, like 70s is hot. 80s is like normal hot. 90s is very, I don't know, or something like that. I was like, why can't people just use Celsius? It's so much easier. Zero is freezing. You know, 30 is super hot.
When some people would like talk about weather in Fahrenheit now, I'm like, wait, what country do you live in? That's so weird.
Yeah.
Zero is freezing. There's like three in the world or something that use that, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So I think both you and I have lived outside for too long, but I'm happy to say, I think I only used my AC maybe once this whole summer. And I don't even have a fan. I could use the fan in my mini split, but I just never turn it on. I just have the windows open at night because it's cool. Yeah.
Oh, good for you, man. Well, Barcelona just passed a rule that public buildings cannot be air conditioned below 27 Celsius.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a big deal, man. I went to a co-working space yesterday and I'm sitting there and I'm sweating. I'm like, what the hell? I went and asked and I had totally forgot. I read it in the news like the day before that they passed this rule. And so it was the exact same temperature outside as it was inside when I happened to be at that co-working space. And but it was a lot of light, you know, a lot of sun gets in this place. I'm like, it's just too hot. I was there for 30 minutes. I started sweating. I'm like, this is not comfortable. So I went home at least turned on a fan. But I went to a museum today and it was the same thing. It's like, it's pretty unpleasant.
I mean, I'm sure it's because they're trying to save electricity, but it's stupid. In Thailand or Asia, it's the exact opposite, where it's way too cold inside. They make indoors like 17 Celsius, or like, you know, in the 50s when it's super hot outside. So, you know, you walk around in shorts and a t-shirt and you get inside and you're freezing to catch a cold. I hate it.
Yeah. I love it though. Like, Thailand's become such an indoor place to be. You wouldn't think about it like that, but the cafes are all like so nice and so cold. It's like real comfortable considering going outside in either the rain, the pollution, the mosquitoes, the drunken tourist. And did I say mosquitoes?
Yeah. So I think AC should always be set at like, let's say 22 or 23, whatever it is. Right. And just leave it like the whole year. So if it gets, you know, cold and below that, you know, it can, the heat should never go above, you know, like low 20s. I don't like it when places are overheated. And then in the summer, they should never make it 19. Like, they should just have it be, you know, 22, 23. And that way you're slightly cooler. You have low airflow, but, you know, it's not as big of a shock to your system and it saves electricity.
There's so many parallels to that dialogue you just went on and this episode. Inflation, like, can't we just set inflation to 2 or 3% and just keep it there and not have to deal with double digit inflation and have to record an episode with Meb Faber about how to hedge our investment portfolios against it?
It would be perfect, right? Like, I think growing up, you know, in our 40 years, we've never had, you know, double digit inflation, and we've never had inflation below 2%. It's always been like, you know, 2 or 3%, and it's, I thought it was going to stay like that forever.
Me too. But I felt like during COVID, where we had a lot of chats about inflation. Inflation's got to be coming. There's like no way this is sustainable. They're printing all types of money. And now I think that they're using the war as a scapegoat, and maybe that's driving it as well. But there's just no way, like, the amount of money that they printed during COVID, I think largely is what the cause of this was all.
Yeah, absolutely. It's I mean, the Russia's war definitely isn't helping. But the two things I think is driving inflation the most is, one is all the money that was printed, especially when they just, you know, randomly gave out, you know, stimulus checks to everyone that, especially, you know, that didn't need it. And secondly, when everybody asks for higher wages because they think inflation is coming, you know, or they think they deserve it for whatever reason, that drives prices up too. So when there's a blanket pay raise or request, you know, minimum wage going up, but also just everybody just demanding higher wages and demanding more money, you know, that money has to be made up somewhere. So prices of everything go up to make up for it. And then it's like a inflationary cycle.
Mm-hmm. Well, what are you seeing now in Kiev, Johnny? I think we've talked about it a little bit. I was just back in the US, so I do have a reference point there. Derek says everything in California is going up like on a weekly basis, but how's things in Kiev?
Here, things surprisingly have not gone up. I'm shocked that prices here don't really go up. Prices also haven't gone down. So even things like real estate haven't really gone down. Everyday shopping, things like that. Things may have gone up by maximum like a few hryvnia, which is, you know, just like an insignificant amount, you know, just like, you know, I'm talking about, you know, coins, right? But what happened was the US dollar has gone stronger. So the exchange rate before the war was 26, 27 to the dollar, hryvnia to the dollar. Now the official rate is 36 to the dollar, which is a huge difference, right? It's like 30% difference.
Yeah.
And the unofficial rate, if you have US dollars, it's 40. So you get like another 10%, you know, bonus. So it's a massive, massive difference. So it depends on how,
That's really interesting, because I'm feeling, it feels the same in Barcelona, where I don't feel like inflation has kicked in, but the dollar's gotten so strong that any inflationary effects here, like, actually, if you hold American dollars, you're winning here, right? Because the dollar's gotten so much stronger and inflation hasn't really picked up. So it's almost like arbitrage in a sense.
Yeah, absolutely is. Absolutely. Like, so if you live in, you know, expensive state in the US where you think prices are going out of control, this is a good time to pack your stuff to sell, you know, before your your apartment, your rent is raised again. Sell your car right now, because it's, you know, everything's like at the peak price, right? Everything's mm-hmm. at the peak price, and move somewhere cheaper, where either to the EU where they use the euro, or, you know, somewhere that just inflation hasn't hit. I mean,
yeah, at least go on a really nice month long vacation in Europe.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's kick in and see what Meb has to say. I think this will be a great episode. It's been a long time since we talked to Meb, but we recorded one of our most classic episodes. I think it was one of our first 15 episodes. But we're going to have him on to talk about what they're doing to hedge against inflation and how to craft your portfolio. And I know he's going to have a lot of good tidbits and insights. So pick it up in the intro, Johnny, and talk a little bit more about what we're doing.
All right. Here's Meb.
This week's Invest Like a Boss is sponsored by Indeed.com. Now, we know a lot of you bosses out there run your own business. And if you do that, you know every single hire counts. And no hiring partner understands that like Indeed. With Indeed, you can attract, interview, and hire all in one place. You can find top talent fast with Indeed's suite of powerful hiring tools like Indeed Instant Match assessments and virtual interviews. And if you hate waiting, like I do, Indeed's U.S. data shows that over 80% of Indeed employers find quality candidates whose resume on Indeed matches their job description the moment they sponsor a job. And that brings me to my favorite feature of Indeed. It's called Instant Match. The candidates you invite to apply through Instant Match are three times more likely to apply to your job than candidates who only see it in a search. That's according to U.S. Indeed data. With Instant Match, as soon as you sponsor a post, you get a short list of quality candidates whose resumes on Indeed match your job description, and you can invite them to apply right away. Indeed does all the hard work for you. Just sponsor a job and boom! You have candidates who match your job post right on the spot. So join the over 3 million businesses worldwide using Indeed to hire great talent fast. Just head to Indeed.com/iLab to start hiring now. That's Indeed.com/ILAB. Indeed knows that when you're doing everything for your company, you can't afford to overspend on hiring. I'll give you that website one more time. It's Indeed.com/iLab. Terms and conditions apply. Cost per application pricing not available for everyone. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Meb, welcome back, man. 4 years.
Good to see you, friend. It's been too long.
Five years. 5 years. 2000, I checked. 2016 when you were on. But we did meet up before COVID in LA when things were more normal.
Well, it's hard. It's hard to keep up with you guys. I mean, it's like a jet setting crew. You and Johnny, I get like updates from Europe and Asia. I live vicariously through you guys. I have a 5 year old now. So but it's weird because I listen to your show and, you know, you feel like you're still keep in touch with someone, even though you don't seem in the real world. So we got to find a reason to hang, go drive some more race cars or Baja trucks.
Yeah. For the listeners, Meb set the, I don't think it was the course record, but it was certainly the event record. In the Ferrari, I believe.
I tell all my friends, I say, if you go to Vegas to race supercars, do not, whatever you do, do not skip the Baja truck experience, because that thing was the most fun experience I think I've ever had in Vegas, like in the back of the park. Make sure you find it. It is so much fun.
I totally forgot you did that until you just mentioned it. What always took me by such surprise was that, like, I'm not condoning drinking and driving. I'm not saying any of us had any beers prior to driving, but I couldn't imagine that at that speed track, you could just walk up, you know, these parties from Vegas, just walking up to a speed track and you could be totally lights out, wasted. And they pretty much let you in there and go drive a car around a track at 150 miles an hour.
The surprise to me was that in both cases, so both on the racetrack as well as on the Baja track, and the Baja track has straight up like enormous jumps. Mm-hmm. In both cases, so on the racetrack, the guy, you know, flying around the track, he's like, hammer it, like basically like, stop being such a baby, like, let's go. And I was like, is he serious right now? And then on the Baja one, you feel like you're gonna do like a roll the car like seven times and flip, and this guy is just like, come on, let's go. And I'm like, oh my god, this is like, I'm gonna die.
Proper adrenaline junkies. Those,
yeah,
I guess whatever you call them, the ride along drivers. Yeah, it was the same similar situation when I was driving, and like they have their own brake pedals. So if you get out of control, they can brake. And I kept waiting for them to brake, and it was always the opposite reaction. It was always faster, faster.
Yeah.
You're turning too early in the turn.
Yeah.
That was great. Good stuff, man. So I think actually that meetup was just a few months before, may have only been a couple months before COVID actually started breaking out across Asia. So man, tell us what has been up in your world.
You know, COVID was a weird time, obviously, mm-hmm. for everyone. I live in Los Angeles, listeners. So as the zombie apocalypse was creeping in, you know, this millions and millions of people, we did like a lot of people and did a drive about. I got a lot of family in the West, and there's a lot fewer people running around Montana and Wyoming and Colorado than there is in LA County. And so we kind of hit the road with at the time it would have been a 2 or 3 year old. Wasn't sure how he was going to behave. It ended up being great. You know, and been kind of settled in. The few experiences over the last couple of years, you know, travel has obviously been a challenge and muted. But, you know, I think I certainly look back with some fondness on all the additional time I got to spend with a little one. And, you know, we're kind of coming out of it now and things seem to be picking back up. We'll see, but you know, it was a crazy couple of years. In the meantime, have a day job running asset management company, and mm-hmm. you know, we always were a little bit remote, but our, you know, most of the team is actually remote now, which is I guess a very modern approach to running a company. But mm-hmm. Other than that, man, it's the end of summer, life's good. We picked the worst time in 20 years to renovate a house. So I know you guys have a lot of experience in the real estate world. I've held out for as long as possible to own ownership, all the romance of ownership of a house. And so we just now, I can't say finished, but almost finished renovating. So we're back in my own bed after like 6 months, which is a nice place to be.
Oh, congrats. What were you doing during that time? Just renting something locally?
You burning bridges on all friends and family for sleeping on their couches. That was one. We took the chance to do some travel. So we were in Puerto Rico and Mississippi and Florida, Colorado. I mean, blanking on where else we went. You know, to just to do a little bit of travel as well as get to see some friends and family and still try to stay connected to what's going on in the world.
Was Puerto Rico at all? It was just for
you know, I got a good buddy down there, Wes Gray. And listeners, if you don't know Wes, he is a crazy PhD quant, former Marine captain, who runs a asset management ETF business called Alpha Architect. Wes very generously shares a ton of research. It's pretty high level quant, but not totally inaccessible for free. But he decamped with his whole family down there. So he's got three kiddos. And so I said, hey, we'll make it a vacation family slash business trip. He's long been, you know, talking about the merits of the lifestyle. And as listeners from your show know, all the benefits of the taxation and approach down there. I don't know that he has my wife and I totally convinced yet, but we had a really great time. I loved it. I had a blast. Got to see the whole island, spent about 10 days there. Beautiful, beautiful spot, wonderful people, great food.
Yeah.
Got some surfing. It was great.
Agree with all that. It was weird. I flew to Puerto Rico from a different country. I forget where it was. It may have been Mexico. And the I don't know, was it customs guy says, welcome home. When I was there, I'm like, what? It's Puerto Rico. I mean, I guess they just basically, for all intents and purposes, everyone there is basically like, this is America.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's very interesting melange of everything, right? It's, you know, very proud heritage of Puerto Rico. There's this odd, you know, sort of arm's length attachment to the U.S. You know, it's always gets voted on every few years about should it be a state, should it not be a state. It's the struggles of being an economic Caribbean island and all that goes with that. And so it's just like, it's, you know, it's a place that there's so much opportunity, and I loved it. I could definitely, I could definitely spend some time there.
There you go.
But that's, you know, it's funny for the listeners, because you guys talk about this on a lot about lifestyle. You know, Wes and everyone I met down there that said, look, you know, if you're coming down here and doing it purely for the tax reasons, you're probably going to be miserable. Mm-hmm. If you're coming down here and you're like, look, this is going to be an adventure. I'm going to integrate myself into this community. I'm like, this is my home. I'm not watching for 180 days, you know, that I need to be here or versus abroad, all that stuff. You know, like everything in life, like the mindset of how you approach it, you know, really has an impact on what the experience is like.
There you go.
So I thought it was awesome.
I think that's great advice, because you hear all these, super, super wealthy people moving there, take advantage of the taxes. And my thought was always like how much money is too much money that you actually want to start designing your life around making more money strictly and put yourself into a location you don't want to be. Like if you're a billionaire, you're going to move there and save. Yeah. You're going to save a lot of money on taxes, but like, do you want to restrict your lifestyle just to make more money that you don't need by any measure? So, but I agree with kind of his points.
I'm the type of person, if you like me down anywhere, and this could be Kansas City, could be Florence, could be Perth, you know, and say, look, you know, you got 2 years, you got 5 years, whatever it's going to be, like, this is going to be an adventure. Think about all the things you can see and explore. Like, I will be like the happiest person. And like, that's totally fine with me. So I would love the adventure side of it. Go surfing, and there's like, you know, these amazing national parks and the Pork Highway. My wife wouldn't do that, but I would. Anyway, so, I did come across people that, you know, and I'm not disparaging my crypto friends, but certainly, you know, some of the crypto crowd was down there seemingly for a very, very specific reason and didn't particularly seem like they were that enthused to be there. So, like anything in life, I think it's all about attitude.
So, just for context, so going back through, I guess it was 2020 when COVID was breaking out, I'm just trying to draw some parallels to kind of what we're going through now with the recession looming. I think the market, the major indexes are down something like 20%. And when we talked to our listeners when COVID broke out, and people were obviously initially quite concerned, but were also aggressively buying the dip. Whereas this time around, it seems a bit different. People are much more cautious. And I wanted to know if you saw similar kind of parallels in people that you're talking to, or even possibly what your personal approach is.
Yeah. So, you know, every cycle and regime is different, and sentiment is always a bit tricky. If you look at the long arc of history with investments, you know, humans, and I'm not just, people love to pick on retail individual investors, but this is the big institutions too. I mean, we're talking the $100 billion plus shops. They make classic mistakes where they get caught up in fads and manias. They get too despondent and depressed and busts and depressions. And the challenge is always coming up with a plan or crafting a portfolio and approach that can withstand any environment, because we don't know what the future is going to hold. You know, one of my favorite quotes we say is, it's like better to be Rip Van Winkle than Nostradamus. Like, everyone wants to predict the future, but really, like, build a great portfolio ahead of time and just kind of let it chill. But so much of it, so many people want to consistently kind of tinker, and often we're humans. We love Twitter polls. So we ask people, do you have an investing plan? And most people almost always say no. And the problem with that is, like, it's like, do you have a diet? And if you don't, you know, and you're hungry and you wake up at midnight, you're going to go have a sandwich or pizza or donut or whatever it is in the fridge. Anyway, so what's different about this 2022? 2020 was obviously a very, I think, scary time for a lot of people. But stepping back, you know, we managed, so just FYI for the listeners, we managed over $1.5 billion across 125,000 investors. So we got a lot of people from all over the world. But the biggest concern, obviously, right now for many is inflation. And that's a topic that almost no one, particularly in America. Now, you guys are much more traveled. Your audience is a lot more global and worldly than most domestic U.S. investors. But inflation is a topic in the U.S. that hasn't been front of mind for this entire generation of investors, right? Like if you're an old gray hair, you know, bald investor, maybe. But we're talking 5 decades ago, you know, that's quite a while before there was inflation that, you know, was meaningful. And so I think that that is front of mind. You know, the pandemic was a different sort of concern. But if you look at 2022 specifically, this is one of the worst starts ever for U.S. stocks and bonds, which is the way most U.S. investors allocate their portfolio.
Yeah.
They put it almost all in U.S. stocks for the stock allocation and all in U.S. bonds. They don't do any other type bonds ever. So sometimes those two are not correlated and they zig and zag. A lot of investors today assume that they will be diversifying, but that's not the historical case, by the way. So this year, 60-40, I think, was down, you know, almost 15%. It's probably down high single digits now. But the problem with that is that most investors, if you ask them what was the worst drawdown, so peak to trough, top to bottom loss for a 60-40 portfolio, they'll tell you they assumed it's like 10 to 20% somewhere in there. And the answer is over 50.
Wow.
And so, you know, the challenge with a buy the dip mentality, look, we say saving and investing by far trumps every other decision you're going to make. How much you decide to save in the first place, when you start to invest, earlier the better, consistently putting that money in, fantastic. However, in the short run, and particularly for the older crowd listening to this, you know, it's a very different scenario. It can feel very emotional and volatile. But this also, the caveat is, and we'll probably get to this in a minute, it cannot just be a U.S. only stocks, long and bond portfolio that is extremely concentrated and dangerous. That was a long-winded answer. Really sorry.
Yeah. Great. They always say, at least some of the initial advice that I heard kind of running through my head when I saw inflation numbers start picking up. I think right now inflation, last I checked, was 9.1% trending for the year. I think that number to me has always been a little bit suspect about how it's gauged and what it includes. It certainly doesn't include everything that we typically go out and spend money on each day. But I mean, I was just back in the States for a week and I'm in a small town in South Carolina. You know how I figured out there was inflation besides like gas and all this and everything else? I go to an Exxon Mobil each morning for breakfast. It's like the nicest Exxon Mobil in the world, but it is just in a totally random place that you would never, ever stumble upon. And they sell breakfast sandwiches there, you know, your biscuits, egg, and bacon. I drive my little golf cart up there each day, and it's always $2.99 or $2.49, depending on if you get it with cheese or without. And now it's $3.99.
Oh my God.
$3.99. And I'm like, it's not even.
I thought you were going to say the Bud Lights went from $2 to $3. Yeah. I saw Bud Light on a menu here in Los Angeles that was $9. And I was like, if we get to the point where the people are charging double digit beer prices for Bud Light, not even some fancy IPA, just some, you know, Bud Light, I'm like, we know inflation's gone too far.
Yeah.
It's been too much.
Exactly. So, I mean, what are you seeing in California on the street level?
I made a joke. This is a while back, but, and this was at a hotel. So hotels are always expensive, but on the menu, they had both a salad and a hamburger that were both over $40. And these didn't have like truffles or, you know, I don't even know what lobster salad or something. It's just like a normal salad and hamburger. And then I was trying to think this morning, actually, I was like, which is more offensive? Like, you know, is it like you had a salad, it's $40. You're like, I'm so pissed. I just paid $40 for salad. Or is it the $40 hamburger? That's like a good Twitter poll. I think both are equally as offensive. You know, look, here's the thing about inflation. It's been around for a long time. You know, you'll see some scary charts from, you know, various media where they're like, look at the purchasing. Look, the dollar has gone down 99% over the last, you know, century. And that is true. Like that's not necessarily a bad thing. And that just means that if you held your dollars and you put them under your mattress, which no one should do, of course, you'll eventually, inflation will erode that purchasing power. Mm-hmm. And inflation, look, in normal times, let's call it 3%, be a great place to hang out. But in the US, at least, inflation is spent a third of the time over 4, you know, mm-hmm. and you mentioned 9. And inflation is a tough topic because it's extremely varied. So you have things like televisions and electronics where it's deflation. They're getting a lot cheaper. You know, most mm-hmm. listeners probably have like a 50-inch flat screen now that's, you know, mm-hmm. not very expensive. But on the flip side, there's things like healthcare and education and other costs that are you know, consistently going up, consumer goods. But in general, you know, inflation north of that sort of 4% starts to impact real world economy, consumer behavior, everything else. Now, I think the challenge for most people is how you deal with that. And that's been a problem that no one has been front of mind. Now you go to Brazil, you go to Argentina, you go to Eastern Europe, you go to, you know, anywhere else in the world, mm-hmm. they're very well aware of currencies and inflation. Mm-hmm. But this has been a problem that I think a lot of people are waking up to, being like, what the hell, what's going on? Particularly the younger crowd.
Yeah, I was looking at my portfolio. Let's just say since we started this podcast almost 7 years ago, my portfolio is up something like, let's just say 50%. And I'm looking at inflation. I'm like, inflation could easily be 15% right now. Running over 2 years, that's 30%. And then in most of my portfolio is unrealized gains. So I still have to pay tax on that. And start like running the numbers, and you're like maybe barely up over the course of 7 years, even though the top level number is much higher. But when you actually strip everything down in terms of purchasing power, taking inflation out, and assuming you're gonna have to pay tax on that at some point, it's like, it's almost like your example, you just said, it's like, if inflation's over 4%, and you make 10% on your portfolio a year, you still have to pay tax on that 10% gain at some point, and you have 4% inflation. It's like, well, it's, you're doing a little bit better than breaking even, but
it's a nice way of saying inflation sucks. That's true. Like, and if you look at a lot of the big institutions, like their main mandate is to keep up with inflation and hopefully outperform it. Right. Okay. And so look, here's the good news is the vast majority of people are willing to let their money sit in the bank account and earn very little. They don't invest it, in which case they consistently will lose to inflation. And that's tragic. But so mm-hmm. what can you do about it, I think, is the best question. And so
yes.
I think a lot of people, we had a tweet about this, but we'll dive in. This will get deep quick. But, you know, they're looking for, often people are looking for the magic bullet. What asset do I buy to protect from inflation? And the real answer we'll arrive at in a minute is a little bit different. But let's start at the beginning. My favorite investing book, listeners, pick up a copy. It's expensive. So get at the library, or there's free yearly updates from Credit Suisse. The book is called Triumph of the Optimist. It's a beautiful coffee table size book. The yearly updates are called the Global Investment Returns Yearbook. There's like a dozen of them at this point. Download them all. They're free. But it shows you investing returns for main asset classes going back 100 plus years in like dozens of countries, as well as the world aggregate. And what this shows, and you can kind of summarize this, and I'm going to say this, so there's the difference between nominal, which are returns that have inflation, or real returns, which are after inflation. So example would be, let's say you had 10% stock returns and inflation was 2, well, your real return is 8%. Awesome. But if you had 10% stock returns and inflation was 8, your return is only 2% real, not nearly as cool, right? But people usually only think in nominal returns. So real is all that matters. Real is what you can eat, right? If costs go up 10% and your portfolio is up 10, it's a wash. So historically speaking, I call this the 5-2-1 rule. Stocks globally after inflation return about 5%. You know, people see the headline, they expect stocks to do 8-10, but you got to take out that inflation, you know, chop, mm-hmm. and you get to 5%. Now, comment on your sentiment at the beginning of the show. The sentiment for U.S. stocks coming into this year, a lot of surveys said U.S. investors expected 15 to 17% returns every year for stocks, right? So peak cycle sort of numbers, which is never, ever going to happen. And what are they, you know, down that much this year? So So stocks globally after inflation, about 5%. Bonds, I'm rounding up, but this is also at the end of this beautiful bond bull market, was historically 2. And then T-bills like around 1. You could probably take those, knock one off those and be 1 and 0, really.
Yeah, okay.
So cash in the bank, CDs, short-term bonds basically keep up with inflation. Longer duration bonds maybe give you like 1%, and stocks around 5. Okay. So then the question is, people say, oh, okay, just put all your money in stocks. Well, here's the problem with that. You know, as you know, stocks go through regular periods of face ripping pain, vomit inducing drawdowns, and they're normal. You know, in the past 20 years, we've been through 2 50-percenters in the US. We had one during the Great Depression that was over 80%. And so that's hard to live through. Now bonds. So then people are like, well, hold on, I just want to save all my money and keep up. So I'm going to put it all in bonds because they don't have these big of drawdowns. Well, problem with bonds is nominally they don't have big drawdowns, so they don't go down much. But after inflation, bonds have declined also over 50%. Right. Mm-hmm. So that's we asked this poll on Twitter. You say, what was the biggest drawdown for bonds? Most people say, like, I don't know, 5%, 10%. The answer is over 50. And so bonds are equally as risky as stocks. It's a different risk. It's like the slow erosion, mm-hmm. whereas stocks is usually like a crash, a price sort of bear market. So people diversify. They put some in stocks and bonds, and that's decent. That's like a good first step. And you've heard me repeat, I repeat myself a bit, but a Twitter poll where we asked people, do you own any real assets? And I'm going to exclude your house for a minute. But so commodities, natural resource companies, TIPS or REITs, and the vast majority of people say no. And there's some Aussies, there's some, some Canadians that are very resource intensive that have some, but most people have almost none. And the problem, there's a great paper, one of my favorite professors, Cam Harvey out of Duke, right up the road from you when you were in South Carolina. He wrote a great paper called The Best Strategies for Inflationary Times. And he goes through and looks at all these, you know, inflationary periods and what does well. And you kind of got to split it up between unexpected inflation and the surge, which we saw over the last year, and then sustained inflation.
Mm.
And, you know, stocks, they do okay. A lot of times with unexpected inflation and the inflation, stocks get killed, which they have in the past year. You know, you look around and there's a lot of stocks that are down 40, 60, 80, 90, 95%. And part of that, not to go too deep on the theory, is, you know, with interest rates, but value stocks that have a lot more cash flows now versus growth stocks that have a lot more cash flows in the distant future, you know, having the interest rates come up with inflation, because usually they're kind of tethered at the hip, is usually bad for these long duration assets like growth stocks, because all your cash is in the future. Well, if you have inflation now and these companies, you know, are raising prices and costs are going up, but you're only going to make money in 10, 20 years, people tend to view value stocks. So if you look at the two big inflationary decades in the US, 1970s and 1940s, this is probably most similar to the 1940s, value stocks did great in both those decades. Okay. Now, the good news is value stocks have done terrible for the past 10 plus years. But I think you're in the early innings of value stocks doing well. Sorry. Long-winded beginning to this discussion.
I remember last time we spoke on the podcast, we were talking a little bit about the 70s, and generally not much did that well, right?
Yeah. And so then there's other things like gold. Gold, it's like coin flip. You're going to see who shows up. You know, are they going to show up or not? On average, gold helps during inflationary times. You never know. It has, I think it surprised a lot of people this year. Gold traditionally does well with negative real interest rates, which we have now, meaning interest rates are below inflation. And it's a very wide spread, arguably the biggest ever. And then when there's a negative, flat to negative yield curve, which we also have now. So I would be surprised if gold doesn't do well in the coming year or two. But it hasn't, and also most investors hold almost no gold. So if you have a port, and traditionally emerging markets or foreign markets can do well during inflation. They tend to benefit because of their sector composition. Mm-hmm. There tends to be a lot more energy, materials, other sectors in emerging markets. If the dollar is coming down, which it hasn't, it's been a massive dollar run for a while.
Europe's cheap, my man. I don't know what to buy, so I just keep buying more wine.
Yeah. Well, I'm a skier, so I need to lock in some ski trips before it rolls over. So, how do you put it all together? And so, we did a post during the pandemic. We did a 4-part series because there was nothing else to do in the pandemic besides mm-hmm. write. And so, it was called the Get Rich Portfolio, the Stay Rich Portfolio, Investing in a Time of Coronavirus, and the last was How I Invest My Own Money. But what's interesting here is we're talking about inflation is the stay rich portfolio. Because if you were to ask someone, you say, okay, and this supply, this is probably 95%, 99% of people, including investing pros, I think would answer this question the way that I'm going to frame it. And I don't believe this. So it's a very non-consensus view, warning listeners. You know, what's the safest thing to do with your money? I think almost everyone would say, put it in T-bills, put it in the bank, put it in T-bills or short-term bonds or CDs. Mm-hmm. And going back to the discussion earlier, if you said, okay, let's look at all the metrics, return after inflation return, volatility and worst drawdown. And you look at cash and cash being invested in T-bills, not cash. Cash is the worst. then you compare it to something like, hey, I'm going to invest in what we call the global market portfolio. So if you just bought every public security in the world, it's roughly going to be about half stocks, half bonds. And of that, by the way, half US, half foreign. So you end up this beautiful diversified portfolio, which you can buy a couple ETFs now, Vanguard, wherever. We have 12, but just pointing out, it's almost free. It's basically mm-hmm. free at this point. And compare that global market portfolio to simply short-term bonds. And then you can mix it with bonds. Say, you know what? I'm gonna put half in cash, half in T-bills, half in this global market portfolio. You can show that across return, across risk, across volatility and drawdown, it is a better idea to invest even your safe cash in this global market allocation mm-hmm. than just putting it in T-bills. And a lot of people say that's crazy, but then you look at the return numbers, you look at the drawdowns, you look at everything, and it's more stable. Now, you can do 50-50. But the point is, you have to have this owner mindset. You have to have this mindset of owning assets. Now you have to, and by the way, the global market portfolio includes real assets. So commodities, mm-hmm. REITs, TIPS, crypto would even work its way in there. So it's like 0.5% right now, I think. It's hard to keep mm-hmm. up. It's so volatile, but it's less than 1% of the global market portfolio. But that ends up being a really great, great allocation. Now, there's one final strategy. We talked about value stocks. I think you should tilt to value and away from growth. But one final strategy. And by the way, you guys are an international focused podcast. The problem with inflation now versus historically is U.S. stock valuations. And U.S. stock valuations on the broad market, if you look at last 120 plus years, average U.S., if you look at a 10-year P/E ratio, mm-hmm. adjusted for inflation, we call it the Shiller-Cape ratio, usually hangs out around 18. Low inflationary times, it's around 22. We hit a peak in this cycle of 40. So we're down to, I think, 30 right now. So good, but that's just because the market's gone down. Mm-hmm. So it could go down a little more to get to, you know, that 22, but not mm-hmm. a lot further. You get down to the kind of the average. In high inflation, if high inflation sticks around, if that 9% prints again, or 10% or even 8, and it sticks around for a while. The problem with that is investors are not willing to pay high multiples on stocks when inflation is high and sustained. Historically speaking, and this is probably my most unpopular tweet of all time. I did this back in January and it didn't even have an opinion. It just made us a factual statement. I said, US stocks are trading at a 40 PE multiple. On average, it's usually around 22. However, and if inflation is high, that PE multiple historically is 12, right? So it's not 22, it's 12. And in both decades, the 70s and the 40s, it hit single digits at some point. Mm. So 12 is a long way from 40.
Yeah.
It's not as long way, but it's still a long way from 30. It's 50% down from here. I mean, I didn't say this is going to happen. I didn't mm-hmm. say this is you know, but people lost their mind. Oh my God, I went crazy about this. But as I said, you have to at least consider the possibility of this happening. And if you look at the value spread within, so, you know, the broad US S&P versus the cheap stuff, it's some of the biggest spread it's ever been. So I think you can hang out in the value stocks and do totally fine or great, depending on what happens. But on top of that, foreign developed is much cheaper. So it's already a reasonable valuation. Mm-hmm. Foreign emerging is really cheap. And then both of those within those two indices, the value stuff within those is really, really to screaming cheap. I mean, there's okay. some emerging market indices that are yielding like 7% now. So anyway, so I'm going to wrap up on a bow on this long-winded diatribe. You're going to do fine if you have a global portfolio. That global portfolio is stocks, a sprinkling of bonds, even in real assets. I think you need a tilt towards value within the stocks. And then lastly, because we haven't mentioned this, but in this CAMS paper, and this was like the very first academic paper I wrote way back in 2007, there's an active strategy called trend following, which is one mm-hmm. of the best things that can protect in inflationary times. Some people call it managed futures. Some people call it commodity trading advisors. You could buy it through ETFs, mutual funds. And they're having a fantastic year this year. Now, trend following is simply you're trying to buy assets that are going up and get out or short them when they're going down. Simple enough mm-hmm. on paper. Mm-hmm. Trend following has struggled for the better part of the last decade. It's having a monster year this year because the beauty is you're not only long the energy and natural resources complex, but you're short a lot of other things that are going down, such as bonds and stocks. And so in times of geopolitical distress and unexpected and higher inflation and bear markets, especially, trend following can really save your hide. So, all right, I'm going to wind. I'm going to stop my long-winded answer. I'm sorry, but you got me off on a tangent.
I love it, man. This is great. I mean, it definitely to just to recall kind of the beginning of this episode, just it's so true. Like there's no real reference point for, let's just say, a millennial investor for this type of period. And definitely it's the inflation that's got me feeling quite concerned and tight. It's not necessarily the war with Russia, Ukraine. Obviously, that if China and Taiwan sparks off, that's something to definitely be concerned. I mean, there's a lot of concerns, but for me, it's more the inflation. It's like, if the market's static and inflation's at 10%, it's like, do I want to be putting money in there? Although it is liquid, but yeah, interesting stuff.
One of the areas we didn't mention, but that you guys talk a lot about in the show that mm-hmm. traditionally does well too during unexpected inflation or sustained inflation is collectibles. So yeah. That's been very popular during this part of the cycle. Wine, art, cars, vintage cars, whatever the collectibles, Game Boy, cartridges, I don't know. But that's another area. That's obviously a pretty small percentage of a traditional portfolio because it doesn't generate cash flows, at least traditionally.
Yeah.
But is one that traditionally does well during inflation too, or can.
Art has been huge with our listeners, Masterworks. And then I keep talking about Colt Wines and wine investing. That's been my biggest investment over the last 12, 18 months. Yeah. And I think what they've created, that they're basically creating a market. So I've been investing heavily there, and that's just been tearing through this inflationary period.
Yeah.
And the numbers historically are incredible, but to your point, there's no cash flow and you end up drinking it.
So, yeah. Well, I mean, look, I think for many people, I mean, we wrote a book called Global Asset Allocation. I need to update it. It's a little outdated now, but it looked a lot of asset allocation strategies, you know, over the past 50 years and took some back to the 1900s. And the big takeaway is your portfolio will probably do fine as long as you include all the real main categories. So global stocks, global bonds, global real assets, mm-hmm. whether it's 33% in each, whether it's 40, 20, 40, whatever it may be, you have to have the main ingredients. And if you don't have some of the main ingredients, if you own no stocks or no real assets or no bonds, usually that can be suboptimal. Not necessarily the long run, but particularly for various short periods. So when we looked mm-hmm. at this a lot of these portfolios, they clustered within like 1% of each other over the full arc of, you know, five decades. But any given year, they can vary by like 20 percentage points, right? So what happens is people are like, oh my God, my 60-40 portfolio is down 20% this year. And I'm looking over here at XYZ portfolio and it's up 10. I got to switch to that. You know, and so they make the mistake of kind of chasing whatever is working, and that's problematic. So coming up with an investing strategy, kind of saying, look, I'm going to diversify globally. I'm going to buy real assets. We love trend following, but that tends to be pretty much an outlier. All of these things, you'll probably do just fine. Doesn't mean it won't be painful at periods and you won't get the FOMO to chase whatever it may be. But usually that's a great approach. And to write it down, listeners.
Write it down. Do you ever buy or invest in any type of like tips or inflation protected jargon stuff?
Yeah. You know, for us, we manage three asset allocation funds, and I'm a quant, listeners, so I'm not waking up tomorrow saying we got to sell IBM and buy soybeans and short the Swiss franc, whatever it may be. You know, they're algorithmic, they're rules based. Yes, we do own tips. You know, I think if you come up with a bond allocation that's like a third tips, government bond, so like a 10-year bond, and depending if you want to diversify stocks or not, corporate bonds, like that's a really smooth, nice allocation over time. Now, the problem with tips and something like a year like this year is they still have interest rate exposure. So when interest rates start ripping up, despite the real component of tips, you know, they have that challenge too. So short-term bonds, if you knew that inflation was coming, you want to hang out in short-term, you know, kind of T-bills and bonds, because they'll adjust up, you know, as inflation comes up.
Yeah.
And you got the I bonds, but you can only put 10K in those. So usually it doesn't do a whole lot.
Yeah. Yeah. I always thought like tips is a lose-lose, because if it just keeps up with inflation, but you still have to pay tax on the gain, then you lose.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's the, you know, the thing about bonds and the challenge, particularly the last few years, is bond yields got to zero and negative in many countries, is people are like, what in the world am I doing with this? Like, why would I ever want to own bonds? And bonds really just help diversify often during a deflationary environment, which is not what we're in right now, right? But theoretically, let's say I can come up with a scenario this fall, we go into a really nasty recession. I don't know. I don't want to say it. I'm ready for like 6 months of just quiet, but just hypotheticals. Let's say China, Taiwan mess, all of a sudden all these things start happening and bond yields just come right back down to 2 or 1%. Then you're going to be super stoked to have bonds in your portfolio, because you'll get a huge capital gain from the bonds as interest rates come down. But at the end of the day, I think it's all about balance. And then the most important thing on all this discussion too is low costs and fees. Avoiding those taxes usually has a bigger impact than, you know, the choice of the specific allocation.
I love it. Good stuff, Meb. Well, before we break, is anything new over at Cambria? Any new funds or white papers? Any new books you're working on?
Man, yes, is the short answer. We have 12 funds. You know, we're about to graduate into being a teenager, you know, or I guess a 10-year-old here next year. Our first fund we launched back in 2013, which is crazy. So, you know, we'll still launch a few more funds. But we got some crazy ideas that we would like to see out there. So listeners, if you got any ETF ideas, hit us up. My company's called Cambria. As far as papers and ideas, you know, we publish a lot of short form content over on Twitter. On the podcast, we'll read some of the pieces we write on the blog. It's probably less than I used to. One that we did recently at the beginning of the year was called Red Light, which is if you look at U.S. stocks historically and put them into four buckets: cheap, expensive, uptrend, downtrend. Historically, the best place to be is in a cheap uptrend. That's not surprising. And that compounds at pretty high rates. The second best, surprising to many, is an expensive market, but that's in an uptrend, which is where we've been for the last handful of years. But when that flips from expensive uptrend to expensive downtrend, is sort of where the pain occurs, which is what we're in now. So stocks are expensive, but they're also going down. And that's not a warm and fuzzy place to be. So we wrote that article at the beginning of the year. I don't think anyone read it. but I do have a couple books in the works, trying to find some time for a summer sabbatical. Summer's almost over. So yep. I don't know when we're going to put pen to paper, but we got some ideas we're kicking around. But other than that,
At one point you're writing an article like every day.
You know, that's what being forced into a small house with a family and a toddler will do for you, is you try to find a place to hide. You know, I got to work on this article.
Got it. Yeah.
My magnum opus. It's a lot about inspiration and what's going on in the world. So it's I wrote one yesterday, a very quick one. This is more like a Twitter article. So it's like 240 characters, but it's interesting. Mm-hmm. I have a whole thread called Things I Believe That the Vast Majority of My Professional Peers, so 75% plus, don't believe. And we're up to 18 now. But number 18 was, I showed a simulation, because everyone in the U.S., by the way, invests almost all their money in U.S. stocks. It's like 80% plus in the stock allocations in the U.S. Home country bias, baby.
Yeah.
Yeah. Our Spanish friends do the same. Wherever Johnny is, they do the same. My Thai friends do the same, on and on. And it's a terrible, terrible, no good, very bad idea. But I showed a demonstration on Twitter. I said, look, take the global market portfolio back to the 70s, and we're going to sub out global stocks for no U.S. stocks. So just all ex-U.S. stocks. Mm-hmm. And what does it look like? And it makes like no difference. It's like 0.3% per year. You can barely see the charts diverge. Wow. And then everyone's ranting and raiding. I was like, how many U.S. investors do you know that own U.S. stocks? None. And then I was like, and then people were just kept coming at me. I said, fine, take it back to the 1920s. Same thing. Doesn't matter. It's not something people want to hear. But I said, look, you can totally exclude U.S. stocks and do just fine. Wow. In your portfolio. So
that is very interesting. Very interesting. Good piece of information and insight to end the episode on. Meb, we'll leave links to everything in the show notes. Do you have anything you want to promote or publish? Send it across to us.
I say come see me, listeners. If you find yourself in Manhattan Beach, California, the land of milk and honey, we'll take you surfing. Go grab a coffee or a beer or whatever your interest is. I would love to see you guys in the real world. I don't know where we're going to cross paths next. Hopefully somewhere. You're going to be in Spain for a while? What's the plan?
Yeah, this is home for me now. It's pretty good. You know, it's basically the exact same thing as LA, but a third the price, better taxes.
Las Ramblas? Is that how you say it?
Las Ramblas. Everybody knows Las Ramblas in Barcelona. It's like it's like ground zero for pickpocketing in Europe.
I had a purse stolen there. Not mine, but my girlfriend's purse stolen within like 10 minutes of arriving in Spain. It was like, I was like, well, you know, I was like, it's kind of a nice experience. Like we can claim like we got the full, my brother who's in Colorado just had a Barcelona exchange student start living with him this week. So maybe we'll convince him to say, hey, let's go do a trip to Spain, go hang out with your crew. So,
yeah. Well, when you move to Puerto Rico, you know, you can fly direct from Puerto Rico here and you get your 180 days in Puerto Rico and spend some of the other time over here.
No, man, I want to go up to San Sebastian, come see you in Barcelona, have dinner, then drive up to San Sebastian, go surfing. I've always wanted to do the pilgrimage. What do you call it? The Northern Spain.
Camino de Santiago. Yeah.
There you go.
We're
long
doing
walk.
You can do just the last 100 kilometers. That's like the much more common thing now. There's probably 20 different routes that you can do the last 100 kilometers on. It takes you anywhere from 4 days to a week. We did it last year. It was incredible. So I want to do that every year is kind of just a, you know, a walking trip.
Well,
people are raving about San Sebastian now. It's like the hot spot. It's like becoming
good.
The
I got a couple spots for you. When you make it up there, let me know. I got some nice suggestions.
Good stuff, man. It's been a lot of fun. Keep us posted on your travels. Stay connected and appreciate all the insights on this inflationary period. How we can
brother,
make some money.
Yeah, brother, fun.
All right. Take care, man.
Sam. There was definitely a sign saying do not come drunk to the Las Vegas Speedway.
Was there?
Absolutely. 100%.
Okay. Well, that's easy enough to print a sign, but like there was definitely no one enforcing it. for sure.
I'm sure if you showed up or like you smelled like alcohol or you, you know, you came in tipsy, you know, with the beer in your hand, that they would tell you, you know, took away. But yeah, you're right. Nobody was, you know, was giving you a breathalyzer.
Yeah. Yeah. If you just quietly have 5 pints of beer across the street and chew some bubble gum, you're sweet.
Yeah. And also by the time you actually start driving, like you've been there for an hour, you know, you have to go through the, not the safety course, but kind of the,
that's a good point.
You know, the tips and tricks. And then you're sitting around. I mean, the best part of it is not driving on that lap. It's literally, you know, hanging out, checking all the cars, going in and out of them, taking photos with it. It was a great time.
It was a super fun time. And part of the fun was just being able to hang out with Meb and Brett and Brew from Pier Street and some of the other guys that were able to join the event. But it was a lot of work to put that on. Pretty, like, how many people do we have? Maybe 60?
Somewhere between, I think, 60 and 80. I think it was a little bit less than 100, but it was a pretty big event. And it was a good event.
It's a good event. It's a lot of work to put those on. That's why I have so much respect for you for the conferences that you put on. Like, I can't even imagine organizing those.
It was like organizing a wedding with 12 brides, you know, because all the like all the different speakers, you know, they had all the questions. They want everything, you know, done their way. It was a nightmare. I mean, it was very rewarding. So every time I did it, I was happy I did. But I want to say that I think that's it. I think the Nomad Summit is officially retired. You know, I haven't, you know, COVID shut down the last one. I refunded everybody's tickets. I don't think I'm gonna start it again. It's just, it's too much work.
Yeah, I feel you on that. And I did get to go to one. I was actually looking very much forward to going to one in Georgia, but we'll have to come up with another reason to visit there.
Well, right now I heard Georgia is super expensive. Like I'm still part of some of the Facebook groups, and someone linked my video where I showed like my $450 a month apartment tour in Georgia and Tbilisi. And someone literally said, why is this exact apartment now over $1,000? It's doubled.
And so what, so why is that? Is that, I mean, linking back into this episode, is that inflation or is it just like modernizing and attracting new capital and becoming more expensive?
Definitely not the latter. It has to do with inflation. The Georgian gel, or whatever their currency is, being very strong due to the Russians dumping their currency there and exchanging rubles for gel. And also a lot of Russians move there, so there's just a lack of housing right now.
Got it. So I you know, I learned a lot on this episode from talking to Meb. I mean, that guy's just got insane knowledge. And and it's not just from reading. Like, it's, I love all the backdating and the historical views and research that he's done across markets and assets classes across time. I actually felt pretty good after this, you know, with his recommendations and just the amount of diversification I've done in my personal portfolio. It's like, I don't really know what I would be doing different, but I feel like going into this inflationary period, like, yeah, it's going to be tough, but I'm pretty happy with where I'm at. Are you making any new moves or adjustments in yours, Johnny?
No, I actually felt the same way. When he had talked about having a diversified portfolio with, you know, international stocks and also, you know, value stocks, it made me very comfortable. Because that's, you know, exactly what I do. You know, I don't have all my money in U.S. stocks. I've always liked small cap value. I've always, you know, diversified with international, even though for the last 5 years it didn't really make any sense. But I just, you know, it, common sense told me U.S. isn't going to be the only, you know, superpower, only economic superpower in the next 20 years. So might as well buy some now.
Yeah, I agree totally. Also, you mentioned resources, real assets, tangible assets. I know both you and I have a lot of property, even if that's in the form of REITs or property funds. Do you still own your MLPs or do you sell all those off?
I sold half of them, but I still have a bunch. And, you know, they kind of funnily go up and down, but the dividends are still very good. And overall, I'm still, you know, double. It's still doubled its values since I bought them.
Okay. One other thing that I did that just I changed is I rolled up another annuity that was making 3% fixed interest. And that sounds awful with 9% inflation because you're basically losing 6%. But it's also better than zero. So right now interest rates are still so low that like the best you can get on a, like a, say a 3-year fixed rate annuity, which I always just say is like the same as a bank CD, is like 3.5%. But if interest rates pick up, that could easily go to 4.5 or 5%. And if it gets up there, then I'll probably look at doing like another kind of short term, like 3-year, because at least it's guaranteed. And who knows, you know, I'm not super keen to put more money in the market right now, even though it'd be historically a discount, but yeah, just figuring out ways to kind of diversify more. I mean, Meb was saying like cash is actually a pretty good place to be right now. And I agree, but you can only take so much 10% inflation with cash in the bank for you. Like, feel like you got to deploy it, right? Or yeah, spend it.
Definitely. I mean, the one thing that we should remember is everybody else is getting poor the same mm-hmm. rate. So it's not like we're missing out that much. I think as long as, you know, we are invested the way we are, we're not going to suddenly, you know, have less buying power than the next guy. Mm-hmm. But it is kind of a not a game, but like a challenge to try to stay afloat, you know, throughout this and come out on top.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Okay. So actions, I guess you and I pretty much sticking where we're at, but encouraged by kind of what Meb's recommendations were. Sound fair?
Yeah, absolutely. And actually one thing that he mentioned that neither of us own are any bonds. It hasn't made sense just because the yields are so low, because interest is low, but it does make sense that even though bonds aren't traditionally traded for equity gains or for, you know, the actual gain in value, maybe buying it now and waiting for interest to go up will, you know, it'll kind of act like a rising stock, where, you know, one day when interest is high enough, maybe it will go up in capital gains.
Yeah, it's not a bad idea. I mean, I own some municipal bonds through closed-end funds, and I always think of the annuities as bonds, although they're not, but that's just a fixed income instrument. But hey, you know, John, if we do what's the rule? If you put your age in bonds, if you take 100% allocation, put your age in bonds and the rest in stocks. You're starting to inch up there to the 50-50 mark, Johnny.
Well, I should be 60-40, but or 60-41, yeah. But I'm literally, you know, 90-0.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, I guess we will see you know, how that works out. I am happy that I did buy some stocks when you know, a month ago when it dipped. All my trades I put in the Patreon, if you guys remember. Mm-hmm. Every time, you know, I buy or sell anything, I put it there first so you guys can see what we're doing. And yeah, it's an interesting, you know, inflationary period we're going through. I do think that part of it feels worse than it probably will be, but who knows? Like maybe we'll have runaway inflation for the next couple of years.
No one can tell. That's why you diversify and try to have some fun along the way.
Yeah.
I know John Thomas always said, like, if you're worried about inflation, just own your house. And if you have money left over, own stocks. That's probably a pretty, you know, a pretty basic way to take a look at it.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, I've been doing the same thing as you and Meb, but instead of buying wine and with surfboards, I guess, whatever he's buying.
Yeah.
Every time I go to the supermarket, I start buying things that I normally would never buy just because I know it'll probably be more expensive next month.
So, you're buying in bulk.
Yeah. So I'll buy, like, you know, 5 packets of rice, you know, all these bottles of wine and liquor, like nice Japanese whiskeys. Even spices, you know, I caught myself buying saffron for the first time just because I was thinking, oh, you know what? It doesn't seem like that expensive now. It's probably going to go up.
I thought you were going to end that sentence by just saying, my hedge against inflation is I go to the supermarket and I buy 5 packets of rice instead of one. Glad you threw in the Japanese whiskey.
Yeah. Well, that as well.
So guys, hope you all enjoyed this episode. I know we already gotten some good feedback just announcing that Meb would be coming back on to talk about this. It's good to have specialized guests that can really help us kind of continue to rethink and remodel our portfolios. If you guys have any other guest recommendations, as always, drop them in Patreon, Boss Lounge, or just email us directly. And Johnny, glad to hear you're still well in Kiev. And I think you're going on holiday this week. Where are you going?
Next week I'm going to Portugal.
Okay.
But yeah, it's, This weekend, I'm actually going to go and do a cleanup. I'm sure maybe you've even seen it. It's like they call it like the Ukrainian like cleanup rave, where like a bunch of volunteers will go. They'll play. They'll actually literally have a DJ playing music while we like clean up rubbish and clean up damaged buildings.
Man, that's amazing. I love hearing these things. Good on you, buddy.
Yeah, thanks, buddy. Yeah. Hope you do well. Thank you guys for listening, and we'll see all you guys next week.
Thanks for listening to the Invest Like a Boss podcast. Join our mailing list at investlikeaboss.com to get exclusive access to our insider investment portfolios and our private members forum.
If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Tell your friends and leave us a review in the iTunes store. It helps more than you know. See you guys next week.